Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a 92-year-old Navy veteran remembers how he earned the Bronze Star in the invasion of Saipan nearly 70 years ago.
I can picture the geysers coming up around me. You know, something's making those spouts of water.
We'll hear about those close calls and the rest of his experiences on two different Navy ships. That's today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 1059, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from members of our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and the sacrifices they've made. We want to preserve their stories so they're not forgotten. And along the way, we get to be educated and sometimes even inspired by what they have to share. I hope that's the case today with 92-year-old Glenn Wine of Atwater, California. A Navy veteran of World War II. There's a Bronze Star on the wall right next to us. We're going to get that story before we're done. But let's go way back. You grew up in Southern California, born in El Monte. What was life like growing up down there? I guess Southern Cal was a lot different?
Absolutely. It was wonderful. It's well depicted by citrus groves, palm trees, snow-capped mountains in the background, and a regular, I'll call it a chamber of commerce condition. Small town, agriculturally oriented. Everything is completely changed now, and you see nothing but houses, people, and no groves, and very little agriculture. I thought it was wonderful. I must also add that I grew up during a time that was not an easy time for the country because I grew up in the Depression years. But it was one of the best teaching lessons for me. We learned to really appreciate what material things we had. I never had the responsibility of providing the home. That was my dad's job. But I'll quote him, and he says, "We grew what we ate, and we ate what we grew." That's not an original, but it was very true. So I never once in growing up ever considered myself, in spite of the Depression, I never considered myself poor because everybody else was virtually in the same boat. Well, not everybody, but many, many people were. So it was a wonderful time to grow up in and a wonderful place to grow up.
Did you have a big family?
I had two brothers, no sisters, but one brother 13 months older than I am, and then I have a younger brother about 9.5 years younger. We call him the off-bloom.
So I'm sure growing up you had some ambitions. What were you looking forward to doing with your life when you were a boy and a teenager down there?
I wanted to be a farmer. One of the few things that my dad ever did give me any advice, if you want to call it advice, on, he says, "Son, there's got to be an easier way to make a living than to farm like I have." I've always been interested in agriculture, but he struggled. My dad farmed, but he was never a farmer. There's a difference. There's a farmer loves to farm, but then there are other people that farm and it's drudgery. And I really felt that in my dad's case, he fit the latter description. It was tough, but he went through a tough time. I mean, trying to make a living was not easy. You could grow lots of things and grow them well, but you couldn't sell them. I mean, what good were they? We raised, I'll call it truck farm, and tree crops. We had plums, peaches, and we also raised a lot of truck crops. Number one was squash. summer squash, and it was on sub-irrigated soil. This is a rarity in Southern California. You don't have to water. We never watered. But you asked maybe what were my ambitions or what did I want to do? Well, as I said, I wanted to farm. Well, my mother diverted this. She dearly wanted to go to college, but she never had the opportunity. She was the oldest of nine children, and her father said there's no way she was going to be going to college when they had her mother needed her there at home to help raise the family. So it was one of the things that we were, as my brothers and I, fortunate in having, well, I'll call it the encouragement to go on to college. And it was basically my mother's doing, I think.
You went to Whittier College, just like one of our presidents did. Whittier College, home of the poets. Where did you graduate from high school?
El Monte. We lived about 3.5 miles south of the city of El Monte, and we rode the school bus. In those days, extracurricular activities were not that well developed as they are now. I don't want to sound as if I was put upon too much, but there was always plenty of work to do on the farm there when we, so as soon as we came home from school, and then we took up farming. And my dad was very generous in saying that if it were not for the help of my brother and myself, he doubted whether he could have made it through the Depression.
Well, I mentioned Whittier College and that a president had gone there. That president was Richard Nixon, and I'm trying to do the math in my head. Were you there at the same time he was?
He was there a little before I was. I think he graduated in 1934. I graduated in 1942. For a small college, we had only a total of about 450 to 500 students total in the college. So to have one of them ultimately go on to be president, whatever you might think of Richard Nixon, because his most famous statement is that I'm not a crook. He had his problems, I guess, but I don't know any of us that don't have our problems. There's not a single one of us, and that includes myself.
If you graduated in 1942, then I guess it would have been your final year there that got interrupted a little bit by something that happened a long way away from Whittier, California. Do you remember how you found out that Pearl Harbor had been bombed?
I was helping my dad deliver wood. The walnut industry was going out. Believe it or not, it had been big, and then it went out. And so there were a lot of walnut trees to be taken out as a means of making an extra buck. He went into the wood business. He contracted to take out trees, sawed up into firewood, and so we delivered it.
Well, how much did you sell a cord of wood for?
$9 delivered. And we were on a delivery at the time when the lady of the house came out and said, Pearl Harbor has been bombed. Well, it was a shock to all of us. We knew there were negotiations going on in Washington by Japanese envoys, whoever they were. It wasn't surprising, I guess, but it was startling. I mean, it actually happened. That was certainly the event that changed the wholesale thinking of the country. It turned it into what I called one of its finest hours. I have never seen it during my lifetime as unified as we were in World War II. I mean, it was it's a big lesson to be learned there. It's a tough way to have to learn it. But people didn't mind sacrificing. Whatever they needed to do was done. We all fought for a common cause, worked for a common cause. I think we completely surprised the Japanese that we could develop this huge military force and presence, which we did not have prior to the happening. But as soon as it did, everything just exploded. The whole tenor of the country went from manufacturing automobiles, refrigerators. They were not being manufactured, and everything was converted over to wartime manufacturing.
What about you personally? How did you end up in the Navy? Was that your decision, or did Uncle Sam tell you what to do?
Uncle Sam had my draft number. We knew the draft board, the local draft board, and somehow I knew about when my number was coming up. I wasn't alone. I mean, we were all in it together. If you happened to be between 18 and 35, you signed up for the draft. But I was also newly married. I got married in 1942. You can imagine, I wasn't very anxious to just go off and leave the situation and go into the service yet. I saw there was an opportunity that came in to go to Caltech and take a seven-month training course for a meteorologist. And so I thought, boy, that's pretty darn good. That's only about 7 or 8 miles from where I live right now. 7 or 8 miles from where I live right now. I'm married, just married. So I applied. So I didn't get an answer. Finally, it came, my draft number was coming up. I was going to have to be drafted in the Army. To be honest, I didn't want to go into the Army. Mm-hmm. I would have much preferred the Navy, which I did. The Navy also had a program at that time called the V7 program. If you were a college graduate to start, that was one of the requirements. And I had just graduated from college. It wasn't 2 days after I enlisted in the Navy, I got my acceptance to Caltech to go to the meteorological program. However, I'd signed up for the Navy, so I said, okay, this is where we're going. And so that's the reason I got into the Navy. It was a little bit by the side door after having been in the Navy. I never once regretted it.
What about your brother, who was 13 months older? Did he end up in the service during the war?
Yes. He had a problem. He had one eye that was not functioning properly, and so he was classed 1B. He did not get a 1A classification, as I had, but he was accepted, and then he went into the Army. They put him into a weather service. I mean, all of our young family, we're all in the service. That's just the way things were then. I mean, it's part of the way things were going. Now, I have to be careful here when I'm going to get politically correct or not. I mean, what my terminology is. But I said, we're going to beat those Japs. Right. I mean, they were not Japanese. However, we had contact with Japanese people there on the farm where we were. And we knew a lot of them. And my school friends were Japanese. But they were not part of the crew that bombed Pearl Harbor.
So you were motivated to defeat the enemy.
Absolutely. However, we were not motivated to the same degree that the Japanese were. Their philosophy, and what I was able to see, pretty firmly believe in, it was an honor to die for their emperor.
Right.
I never felt that way. I mean, so you can say, I fought to live. I mean, I didn't fight to die.
Well, and you had a wife to come back to. How hard was that to have to say goodbye to your wife?
Well, we had about 3 months together. We were married in August, and I left in November. Well, I just hated to do it, yet I knew it was in the cards. We knew it was in the cards when we got married. But two things that I think of as a serviceman, one of the most important things of all was not the chow, not the food, although everybody griped about it, but mail call. That was the highlight of your life. It really was. So if any of you have, whether they're relatives or friends or in the service and they're overseas, send them a letter. It is worth its weight in gold. And our mail delivery, when you're out in the forward areas in particular, very, very sporadic.
Yeah.
This is in response to to a letter my wife had written. I had 42 letters that she sent and I had received, the latest of which was saying that our son was born. And this is my response to her on finding that out.
Well, I want to ask you about that, but I'll try to take you chronologically through what you experienced in the Navy in World War II, and it was quite a bit. We'll try to fit it all in, because you served on two different ships. You were part of five different amphibious landings. The first was Macon Island?
First was Macon Island. I was on an APA number 50, the USS Pierce. It was one of the earliest landings in the Central Pacific. They had had Guadalcanal before I got into the service, but in the Central Pacific, the Gilbert Islands was about the first step beyond Pearl Harbor. I mean, Pearl Harbor, of course, was our base, our home base. It was when you got back, now we may think, talking about where we are in the United States, we think of Pearl Harbor being a long ways away, but we thought we were practically home then when we got back to Pearl Harbor. So on Macon, the landings were not that difficult.
Well, I'm going to stop you there because it's break time. We'll hear about Glenn Wine's Navy experience, difficult and otherwise, including the one that earned him the Bronze Star. You can read his citation for that on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Our World War II veterans deserve a chance to see their memorial in Washington, D.C., and you can help send them there simply by renting a car. Between now and the end of October, visit any Enterprise Rent-A-Car location from Bakersfield in the south to Tulare, Visalia, Hanford, Selma, Fresno, Madera, Merced, all the way north to Sacramento. Tell them you heard this ad on Hometown Heroes, and Enterprise will donate 10% of your rental to Central Valley Honor Flight. Restrictions may apply. I'm sure you're familiar with Enterprise, but do you know why the largest car rental company in the U.S. is called Enterprise? The company's founder, Jack Taylor, was a decorated F-6F Hellcat pilot in World War II, flying off the deck of the Big E, the aircraft carrier USS Enterprise. Maybe I should get him on the show sometime and he can tell us how he earned the Distinguished Flying Cross. In the meantime, choose Enterprise for your next rental. Tell him you heard this advertisement on Hometown Heroes, and you'll be helping to send our World War II veterans on one more tour with honor.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, 92-year-old Glenn Wine of Atwater, California, originally from El Monte in Southern California. He is a decorated Navy veteran of World War II, having served aboard two different ships. First, the attack transport USS Pierce, APA 50. And in November of 1943, you got your first taste of action at Macon Island in the Gilberts. The same day that Marines entered a bloody battle at Tarawa, you were taking soldiers from the 27th Infantry into the shores of Macon Island?
That was our main job. Otherwise, while you served as a deck officer, served your watches, we would probably not have control of the ship because we were just beginning ensigns, and we did not have the responsibility of the entire. Later on, we did. But our job was to carry troops, and we had what they called LCVPs, and they would carry about 36 men. So we took them into the beach. These happened to be from the Army troops on the Macon Island. Tarawa, they had Marines that landed, and then they ran into a far more difficult situation at Tarawa than what we did at Macon. Now, we had our problems there, but everything was wrapped up in about 4 days.
When you saw what happened at Tarawa, you were thankful that you were at Macon Island.
Yes. We couldn't believe how come they aren't finished, because we were.
Let's talk about yours at Macon Island. Yeah. So you were driving the Higgins boat, the LCVP?
I was in charge of a wave. Each officer had responsibility for six LCVPs that constituted a wave of boats. It was my responsibility to keep the others in circle and on timing and movement and everything, and go in so that everybody go in at once. I mean, they had to be timed.
So you were the first boat of the six to get to the shore.
You might be able to get all six in, depending on the weather, I mean, the landing conditions as to what you could do. They would land there, and you were just responsible for those six boats. But what happened was, as I said, a disappointment to me. Each ship in our landing force had to leave behind one officer and 10 boats to use for unloading incoming cargo ships. There were no docking facilities or anything like that. So it was our job, and we call it a boat pool. So I was left, I use the word left, on temporary additional duty is what my orders said, to the boat pool.
So you stayed there on Macon Island for a while, but when you guys went in, did you encounter any enemy fire or anything when you first went into Macon Island?
Not really. A bit, but we did not encounter much. That was the reason it seemed so strange that they were having this endless problem at Tarawa. But I will say this, there were a lot of things that had to be learned by everybody. These Army personnel that we had were first-timers, too. They weren't veterans. The colonel who was in charge, he was killed by a sniper. They had a lot of snipers in the palm trees.
When you saw stuff like that, when you saw him gunned down, did it change things for you at all? Did it hit you at some point that, you know what, this is pretty dangerous?
I was not truly at the site when that happened.
But you heard about it, and you started to realize this stuff was happening. So were you afraid for your own life?
Not in Macon. Besides, there is a feeling that comes over you that it will never be you. You may see somebody, one of your buddies, one of your comrades, one of your fellow men that gets killed or hit or injured, but you never think it's going to happen to you. That was my thinking on it. Well, I knew the realization was that it was there, but it's going to be somebody else.
Where do you think that came from? Was that just being self-confident? Was knowing you had to be home for your wife? Was that grounded in your upbringing? Where do you think that came from?
That's a good question. I don't know. I really don't know where it came from. Maybe I wasn't closely enough at that time to the actual fighting. Maybe that would have instilled more of a concern in me. It might have. But we didn't. Our casualties on Macon were pretty light. They really didn't have that many.
And how long did you stay there?
2 months.
What were you doing for 2 months?
Running the boat pool, unloading cargo ships. They would come into the lagoon and tanker. Well, those atolls or often in circular conformation. They would have a gap maybe in there that a ship could get into and into the lagoon. We had CBs there that were building a fighter airstrip on the island. As they started immediately on that, one of the sites that just as graphic as can be with me right now is seeing a B-24, which had been on a previous bombing raid up to Kwajalein, which was the next group of islands. They had gone up there, whether it had been hit by some kind of anti-aircraft fire or something, I don't know. But he was disabled, and he had one landing gear, and one of his landing gear was down and extended down, and the oven was up. So he was coming into the land. He had to try to land on this fighter strip, which built out of Marston matting. They were not built for bombers in any manner. But when you're looking for a place to land, there's say, any port in a storm.
That's right.
And so that was what he did. And he came in so low to try to take full advantage that he clipped that landing gear that was down on the wharf that we had out there, and it just extended. Well, he did a belly landing. And then that allowed him, I mean, he was strictly belly landed in there, tore the heck out of the Marston matting strip. But he got everybody down, and I thought that was one of those sort of miracles that occasionally can happen. That was a very graphic situation that sticks with me. You say, well, are there certain things that stay with you? Yeah, that's one of them.
Well, I want to hear about some more of them. And I don't think you ever made it back to the Pierce, did you?
I'm sorry to say, no, I did not. I was very disappointed in that because, and in fact, I sent a letter trying to tell BuPers, as we call it, the Bureau of Personnel, try to tell them what to do or what not to do is just like talking to the wind. I mean, yet I wanted them to clarify my temporary additional duty requirement and statement, as my orders said. And then they came back with the answer that, no, you had been dropped from the Pierce staff, and so you were going to be reassigned. And at that point, I went back to Pearl Harbor and was reassigned then to the LSD-6, the Lindenwald. That's where I served the bulk of my time out in the Pacific.
LSD stands for Landing Ship Dock?
Landing Ship Dock. That's correct. Their main role was that you went along with the landing force, but you carried the medium tanks preloaded in a little larger landing craft called an LCM, and we had about 18 of them that were taken into we called it the well deck. It's like a dry dock. They would pump, raise, or lower the ship at will, and let down a big stern gate on the end, and then these preloaded LCMs could come in, and then you pumped out the water, and then we went along at the same time with the assault transports, the APAs. But it was actually a very, very useful vessel. I've laughingly, jokingly said it's outlasted the battleships. We no longer make battleships, but we still make LSDs, even today. It was a surprise because it was originally a British design, untested, really, yet it was a very helpful piece of equipment there to have, particularly in the forward areas, because with the coral conditions and everything, you had a lot of ships that get damaged and had to be repaired, smaller craft of all kinds, that they could take in anything as large as an LSM. They could take in LCTs, but not LSTs. LSTs were too big for them. I mean, they were on their own.
Well, let's talk about what you did on the LSD. And you would make four more landings in Saipan and Leyte and the Lingayen Gulf and finally Okinawa, the last major battle in the Pacific. There's a bronze star on your wall that you got at Saipan, and thankfully it's framed with a citation so I can read this. And the admiral said that this bronze star, now I'm going to read it, don't start laughing, for distinguishing himself by meritorious achievement as officer in charge of a landing craft on June 15th, 1944 during the assault and capture of Saipan, although subjected to intense enemy mortar and gunfire, he, with professional skill and outstanding leadership, caused his tank-carrying craft to be brought to the beach, thereby enabling the successful landing of the vitally needed equipment. Through his exceptional and courageous performance of duty, he contributed immeasurably to the success of the assault operation. His conduct throughout distinguished him among those performing duties of the same character. So the admiral thought you did something pretty special, but you're poo-pooing that. Why?
I was just doing my job. I wasn't doing anything special. I didn't think. True. I mean, you could see the geysers coming up all around you, all right. I mean, I grant that. But we all did that.
So you're in charge of this LCM headed to Saipan.
Right.
And the Japanese are shooting at you.
Yeah. There was a coral reef on the beach where we were supposed to go in. And we couldn't get, we couldn't get landing craft in. Similar to a situation such as they had at Tarawa.
Yeah.
But you couldn't get these tanks, such as we had on our LCMs. They couldn't go in over these conditions. We had to get them in closer to the shore, which we did. The Japs forgive my terminology. They knew far better than we did. They'd been there and they'd been living there all this time. They knew where the openings were in that coral reef. That's where they concentrated their fire.
You're getting hit by enemy mortars and gunfire, or just all around you?
All around us. We never got hit. I can picture the geysers coming up around me. And, you know, something's making those spouts of water.
So that sounds a little different from the reception you got at Macon Island. In this situation at Saipan, did you find yourself thinking, you know what? I might not make it back to see my wife again.
Now, this is an interesting thing. Some of the LCMs, including the one that I was on, were grounded on the shore in that they had damaged their, we call it a screw, the propeller, to the point there where we could not get it off. We had to, quote, abandon that ship. But we got back. There were other army ducks, as we called them. Yeah. It's another type of self-propelled vehicle, and they're not very seaworthy, but they did, and they got us back to the ship.
So you're on the shore, and they'd been shooting at your landing craft coming in. Are they shooting at you while you're on the shore?
Not as much. We had a landing force from our ship that went ashore. They were helping with trying to keep the flow of traffic and taking care of landing craft that were damaged and couldn't take care of themselves. We did not have to stay in the severe battle area very long. It was the intent that we not do that either. You both had to clear the beach and clear the landing.
You just had to deliver the tanks so they could have them for the battle.
Let me tell you one thing. We had Marine Corps personnel this time. One of the Marine officers that was there told me a story that I thought was most revealing. I told him, I said, you know, boy, you fellas really have the tough job. All we have to do is to get you into the beach, and then you've got to go ahead and do the fighting. And he says, let me tell you something. You just get me to the beach. He says, I don't like it out here on this water. He says, I don't swim. And so you just get me to the beach, and we'll be all right. And we got him to the beach. But I should tell you that man also was killed. I learned this later. So there is no real certain or given about anything. It was one of those things that I thought was kind of unique. Each of us felt maybe we were in a better place than the other.
That is interesting. It's all about perspective, isn't it? We're thankful you were in the right place, and I know your 3 kids, 6 grandkids, and 8 great-grandchildren are. More to come with 92-year-old Glenn Wine, including his experiences with the infamous kamikaze attacks of the enemy. Thanks to Debbie Land of Merced for letting me know about Mr. Wine and his story, and we'll get the rest of that story when Hometown Heroes continues next after this. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis, its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest, Glenn Wine, 92 years old, of Atwater, California. Speaking of Atwater, it's going to be a hopping place this week. You've heard me talk about the incredible Castle Air Museum a time or two. And this next week, on Wednesday, October 16th, the museum will be receiving one big new addition. At 1 o'clock on Wednesday, be there in Atwater, and you can see a plane that once carried Presidents Ronald Reagan and Bill Clinton as Air Force One. It is a Douglas VC-9C, and it's landing Wednesday at 1 o'clock at Castle Field with the reception on the tarmac to follow. Our guest today, Atwater's Glenn Wine, had a special addition to his family while he was still serving overseas with the Navy in World War II. What was it like to have that mail call and find out your son, your firstborn, had entered the world?
That was, well, my letter here would expound that, and I'm not going to read it to you.
Why not?
No.
You going to get too emotional?
No. But that was one of the happiest days of my life, of course. I realized that the wife had given birth to a son, and she was doing fine. So that was a big day. It's also, you can put two and two together. We were back in the States to pick up another load of boats. We were only been here for about a week. But it was at that point then that our son was conceived. And there were several others on the ship. We all had passed out the cigars and put up the notices.
So you're saying 9 months or so after you all were back home, there was a bit of a baby boom from your ship?
Bit of a baby boom.
When you knew that that he was in the world now, was that an extra reason to get through this and get back home?
Oh, I just wanted to get back home, period. However, it was wonderful. I mean, when I got home, he was 6 months old when I got back. But the main thing that we were trying to do was to get the war over.
What about the toll that some of this takes? As you're delivering troops or you're delivering tanks, did it start to weigh on you when you realized how many Americans were dying to try to win this war?
No. It was part of my thought process that I said it was always somebody else. I never really suffered thoughts in that regard.
Did you ever lose guys that you knew pretty well?
I mentioned the one Marine captain that he roomed with me aboard ship. We did have one man killed aboard ship. Once again, I said it would be very interesting to see what the statistics would show as to how many people were killed or injured by our own fire as there were by enemy fire. And I'm thinking primarily of the flak, which is what this man did, particularly at the end. We had so many ships, everyone firing up there at some bombers that may be going over. Whether they could hit them or not, they did probably didn't. I didn't even see them ever hit any of the bombers.
So this guy on your ship was killed by anti-aircraft fire from another American ship?
He was killed by flak, exploding shells up there. They came down and it hit him. He had a Mae West on, but it happened to hit him right in to go between there. And so we had a burial at sea, which was a kind of a sobering experience. But I never had any close friends that were ever killed.
As that war in the Pacific went on, the later it got, the more the Japanese started to employ those kamikaze attacks. I'm guessing that somewhere along the line, especially by Okinawa, that you saw some of that firsthand. What do you remember?
Well, I can remember specifically the one that made the dive on our ship and missed.
This was at Okinawa?
This was on Okinawa, in Buckner Bay, they called it. It originally was called Nakakasuko-wan, but they renamed it Buckner Bay. We were anchored there for 3 months after the landings. Because of our, I'll call it the versatility and the availability of the docking facilities, other ships couldn't do what we could do in repairing. And so we were there for 3 months. During that time, I'll always remember this. We'd been there for quite a while. And then a ship just came in the night before, brand new ship. You could tell by the paint. I mean, you can tell whether they're, how long they've been out there or whether they're just from the States. They came in, anchored there in the same bay there that we were. The kamikazes, they could attack at any time, but oftentimes it was right at daylight, that they would make an attack. This ship came in, anchored there. The very next morning, a kamikaze came in and hit the bridge. And it just, I don't know how many people were actually killed or injured or anything, but I thought, boy, we've been here for several months, and we didn't have, and we did have one that came after us, but the rest of the time, but this, we'd been there all this time, and he had just come in from the night before. My thinking was that they must have thought this is a pretty tough situation.
Tell me about the one that came at your ship. Why did it miss? Did you guys shoot it down?
Yes. Whether or not we deserved it or whether anybody else deserved it, it'd be interesting to know how many people deserved or took credit for shooting down a plane and which one really did it. Who knows? However, I know one thing, that we had all kinds of friendly fire that was more hazardous. I mean, he missed. Maybe we hit him. I don't know. But he just went over the top of the ship and went into the water. Just didn't hit the ship. I mean, there were just all kinds of holes that we had, not from the kamikaze,
but from other ships. And where were you when that kamikaze came over?
Well, that's my battle station, which is aft on the dual 40-millimeter mount on the aft.
So you saw him coming in?
Oh, yeah, sure.
What do you think would have happened had he hit the ship?
Who knows? I don't know whether he had what kind of bombs he had on him or not. My guess is maybe he didn't, because he came in from, seemed to be, have come in from a land-based situation right there on the island. So I don't know what damage. It all depends upon where they hit. I mean, sometimes it's not so bad. Sometimes it's disastrous. I mean, if he happened to hit a magazine or something like that, and that's curtains. But we didn't suffer any damage from the kamikaze. He's coming in at just at, I'll call it, ship level. And so somebody's over here firing. I mean, who's going to control it? I mean, everybody's thinks they're going to shoot it down. Well, they don't worry about where those shells are going to end up.
Right. They don't plan on missing. I know we're almost out of time here, and I know there's a million more stories you probably have, but you've probably been asked this one before. When you look back on all the time you spent in the war and all those landings, what would you say was your closest call, the closest you came to not being here talking to me right now?
Yeah. I also had one other opportunity. I was the officer of the deck later on in the war. These are things that you say, can you picture? Two high-altitude bombers flew over and dropped bombs on us. Two on the starboard side and two on the port side. I don't know whether how big those bombs were, but whatever they were, it would, if had they, any of them hit a ship of our type, well, it would have potentially could have been curtains. But that's the only other experience I had that was close. You haven't asked me what we thought of General MacArthur.
Let me guess. Dugout Doug?
He got it.
So you weren't necessarily a fan of the corncob pipe?
Not really. And we got shuffled off into the 7th Fleet. I mean, we wanted to be in the 5th Fleet with Nimitz, but then they also had the 7th Fleet, which was MacArthur's Navy. And he was coming up from New Guinea on his way back to the Philippines in his return. Anyway, we made the landings on Leyte. That was the next landing that we made. It was the most peaceful beach that you can ever, ever imagine. Big strand out there, sand all over. We had been used to coral and rocks and reefs. It wasn't very long thereafter till, and it was virtually unopposed. Right. I mean, the landings on Leyte itself. But what comes up next is shows this picture of MacArthur going in with up to his, he didn't have to get his feet wet. He had to back off, stage it all, and he was, I call it a real glory seeker. Now, he was revered by all of the Filipinos, of course, and then the Japanese later on, he was revered, but Harry Truman didn't like him, but anyway.
But it rubbed you the wrong way because your responsibility was getting people ashore there. You knew that he didn't have to get his feet wet, so that was just a photo op.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I'm talking about. That's not very nice. I should think of.
I can understand why you would feel that way at the time. I do want to ask you, before we run out of time, when you have a situation like the one that Citation describes at Saipan, or where the bombs fall on one side of your ship and not the other, and here you are hoping you're going to get back and see your wife and that son you've never met before. When all those things happen, do you feel like somebody was looking out for you?
No, I didn't. I really didn't. And I there's something wrong with me, but it should. I think I ought to be smarter than I really am. I mean, I ought to be able to recognize that something or somebody is taking care of me.
How do you feel about it now?
I still have a tough time. Yeah. It's one of the things that's of my life that is very difficult for me to realize that there's something other than things of my own doing. I mean, I think I'm in charge, and I know I think I know I'm not.
I like the way you put that. Well, when you think back on all of it, because you had quite a few experiences in World War II. That's a long time in the Navy. 5 landings is a lot of landings to be involved in. When you look back on it all, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
I really didn't think that I was doing anything particularly different than many, many other people did. But the thing that I'm the proudest of was the fact that we won the war. Tough as it is, I was wholeheartedly in favor. When I found out about it, Harry Truman had decided to drop the atom bomb. What did really concern me, and we were on our way, we came back after having been there 3 months in Okinawa, and we were on our way back, and we were in, believe it or not, in San Francisco when they dropped the atom bomb. So it meant that we got out. The release system worked beautifully for me. Some of those other guys have been out there for months and maybe years, plenty of points to get back. But if you're out there in one of those islands, the system doesn't work very well. I was very fortunate in that respect.
Would you have been heading back to land more troops or tanks if he hadn't dropped the bombs? You would have been going to Japan?
Absolutely. That was our understanding, that we were coming back and going to land on Kyushu. I'll tell you, but that would have been a very, very tough and questionable thing, whether we can. True, we've been handling at a great distance and keeping a lot of men going over there, but we did not have the homeland of Japan to fight. They were rabid. And we would be ourselves if somebody were to invade us, but maybe not to the quite to the degree that the Japanese were.
Well, and I've seen, you know, the official government estimates that were prepared that invasion would have cost 1 million American lives. Is it your opinion that by President Truman giving authorization to drop those bombs that maybe he saved your life?
Sure. It's everybody's. I mean, the potential.
Yeah.
No, I was giving hell Harry. And so that's what came about.
I think you've got some children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren who are thankful that it worked out that way, because otherwise they might not be here. I know we're out of time, but I want to thank you for serving our country and thank you for telling us these stories. Is there anything else you think we really ought to know?
I mentioned it, I think, a little earlier, that it was our finest hour, tough as it was. That, to me, is one of the greatest things about this United States of America that we have, that we can, it's too bad in a way that it takes something as severe as a wartime condition to bring us together. No, I said it's an experience that I would not have asked for, yet having gone through it and survived it, I've been grateful for all of that. I think it's been an added dimension to my life.
Well, and your story has certainly added to our understanding today. Thank you, Mr. Wine. That's Glenn Wine, 92 years old, of Atwater, California. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes today. Please join us again next time for more stories from our greatest generation. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you that freedom is not free.